This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Canada, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. Cass Ingram, a.k.a. The Wilderness Doctor, is here in hour one to talk about COVID-19. He'll also discuss several studies, as well as his own informal human trials, that have shown some promising results regarding wild oregano oil and several pathogens, including coronavirus. We're not talking about a cure here. We're just saying, based on the studies, this is something that's worth looking into further. Coming up in hour two, Dr. Al Proffitt is a retired university professor and a paranormal researcher. He'll be here to discuss several of his fascinating investigations. Carlos Cagina is my technical producer, and Ryan White is the live stream producer. However, there is no live stream tonight. This program will be posted to my YouTube channel, Strange Planet, in the next several days. And by the way, we've reached 20,000 subscribers at Strange Planet, the YouTube channel. Let's get it to 21,000, shall we? Can you help? Cass Ingram is one of North America's leading experts on the health benefits and diseases and disease-fighting properties of wild medicinal spice extracts. Cass has written over 30 books on natural healing. He's given answers and hope to millions through lectures on thousands and on thousands of radio and television shows. His latest is COVID-19 Remedy. Dr. Cass Ingram, welcome back to The Conspiracy Show. How are you, my friend?
Hey, it's a super pleasure. Great. How you doing?
Terrific. Are you sheltering in place, following all the protocols?
Are you kidding? The only thing I'm doing is I refuse to go to a grocery store where they say you can't come in here unless you're wearing something or you have a purple shoes on. Forget it. I'm passing. I'll eat out of my freezer. That's the only sheltering in place. Otherwise, I'm just active. God.
But following social distancing and things
like
that.
No, I'm not doing any of that stuff. Are you kidding? I have COVID people coming to see me. I don't pay any attention to any of this stuff. I'm sorry. That's just me.
Well, let me ask you first of all, right out of the chute here. We're hearing a lot now from U.S. intelligence and other quarters that this is not a natural virus. In other words, it didn't evolve and then jump from one animal species to humans, that it was somehow created, not necessarily as a bioweapon, but it was created in a lab.
Here's what I think we can say definitively. And definitive is a lot different than watching a bunch of YouTube videos and you know, blogs, and you're not sure what you're seeing. In 1918, there was a problem. A lot of people died. It was from vaccines. I'm sorry. I just have to tell you. In 1976, there was the swine flu. Okay? And it was in Fort Dix, New Jersey, and it was limited to about 200 people, including one serviceman dying. It was from the vaccine they gave, the flu vaccine. In 1977, there was the Russian flu, and the Russians and the Chinese were researching vaccines because they were worried about swine flu. It got out. They did a trial. It got out of the box, and it created a mini pandemic. In 2009, we have H1N1, which the farm industry made government change it to from swine flu to H1N1 to protect the industry. It was from inoculations given to pigs that mutated to have a human, a bird, and a pig gene. So what do you think this is? Something new that came from a bat? Yes, there is a problem, but it rather than being created in the Wuhan lab, it could have just as easily been a vaccine that went sour, you know, because they were giving them to the pigs.
Right. Now, here's confirm or deny. What I've been reading and hearing, and you've been seeing many of the same videos that I have and so forth, is that for this virus, which is basically SARS-2, in order for it to evolve so that it could have jumped from, let's say, a bat to a human, that evolutionary process takes something like, it could take up to 800 years.
Yeah. Look, we've been around here a long time, since the caveman or something, I don't know, and we have no evidence that somebody ate a rat or a bat and caused the whole society to go sour, the whole world. It's not a good idea to go around eating rats and bats, but it couldn't mutate to the human being and then, like you said, spread to China, to Korea, to Singapore, to Japan, then cruise ships, then America and Italy and Europe. No, it's impossible. So you can forget the wild animal to human. It's finished, done. It didn't happen. But what's the closest animal to a human? It's the pig. What happened in China? 350 million pigs died from coronavirus infections in the last 2 years. Could it have jumped from bats to pigs to humans? Yes. Could it have been natural? I don't know. Was it likely vaccines that agitated it? Most likely. Was it a biolab accident? Probably not something that they were making and putting in a petri dish. Probably that did not come out of the smokestack. Maybe some other mechanism. But here's the deal here, okay? The deal is the last five pandemics were from industrial farms and vaccines.
Vaccines given to the pigs.
Yeah, pigs, chickens, in this case, pigs. There were illicit vaccines being sold in China because they were desperate, and they were also homemade. Scientists trying to sell their vaccines, making it up illegally, not through the government channel, and giving it to the, and selling it to the pig farmers, selling it to the industrial farms. But this is all published in the Chinese literature. And by the way, top scientists in China, they've not been that unforthcoming. They actually, you can find truth there. They published a study in 2019, March, that, look, we're going to have a problem here. We are seeing a virus that has originated in bats now to swine in the swine population, and then it will go to humans and we'll have a pandemic. This was 7 months before the outbreak. That's what we do know. And there's lots more to it.
All right. So let me just get your take on a couple of other things. First of all, this quarantine, which just seems to be interminable. We are now, I believe, in our seventh or eighth week up here in Canada. Is it working? What's the science behind this, that this is the way to tackle this problem, given that, so for example, in Sweden, yes, they've had nearly 3,000 deaths, but we don't know the number of cases, because of, you know, lack of widespread testing, unless you know the denominator, the case fatality rate is, you know, you can't know it, but they haven't destroyed their economy in the process. That's the point.
Yeah. Here's what we do know. If you have a breakout of a drug resistant bacteria in a hospital, you have to quarantine the patient. But we have no data, no proof that quarantining a society would have anything, any positive benefit whatsoever for a global spread of a sort of a animal virus or some sort of mutated virus. We have no proof. It's just done on supposition. And Sweden's done okay. We've not done too well. It's America's 70,000 deaths. Canada's done well. This is a pocket disease. You have to deal with the pockets. That's what China and Korea did. Not quarantine a society, no.
Well, let me ask you quickly then about the fatality, the way that the mortality is being reported, because Dr. Brix, who's on the task force, the coronavirus task force,
yeah,
she said very early on, and this is not a direct quote, but she, and people can go and check this, she said, we are being very liberal when reporting mortality. In other words, and then she went on to say, if you have COVID-19, in other words, if you die with it, we're reporting that as a COVID-19 death. Now, that's not the way we normally approach these things.
No,
so can we trust that 70,000 figure?
Yeah, it would have. There's two things. First, she should not do that. If the pathology report shows massive COVID-19 viral infection of the lungs, then report it. And if the pathology report doesn't show that, then you cannot report it legitimately as... because it could be the comorbidity issues and the virus is incidental. No, this is completely aberrant, bizarre, never done before. The second issue is that we don't know how many fatalities occur in somebody's home. What we do know is that there's a monstrous number of deaths in the hospitals, nursing homes. Now, let's look at that. There's an 80 to 90% death rate for intubation plus respirator. In some centers, it's 97%, China reported. And then the nursing home. So you have the issue of drugs. If you give drugs for the influenza, you'll kill the patient. It's the same with COVID-19. You cannot give drugs of any kind. You will interfere with the immune system and the patient will die more at a far more rapid rate. There's some question whether the hydroxychloroquine is working. I think they're saying that if we add zinc to it, it does, and I'll get to that. But drugs are a bad idea with viral infections, especially cold and flu.
Well, here the thing is, when they put someone on a ventilator, that's incredibly invasive.
Invasive.
And incredibly stressful. Like, people panic because you're
having this.
So they give them a sedative. They might even give them morphine. That's suppressing the immune system.
There's two things there. There's the issue of the common drugs like Indocin, prednisone, and perhaps the remdesivir and these different antivirals. The second serious issue is exactly what you said. The only way you can control a ventilated patient is to sedate them. And that's catastrophic to the respiratory system. The absolute worst chance you're going to give a person is to give them sedative drugs while they're on a respirator, or even if they are not. If they have the flu, you can't sedate them. The body's fighting to get this stuff out, respiring, in exhalation, inhalation, and you're going to suppress the respiratory system. You're going to cause fluid accumulation and collapse of the lungs. And if you give Indocin and Motrin, you'll cause the lungs to bleed and the patient will die. There's two things. The mechanical ventilation and the drugs, there's a third one, secondary bacterial infection from a mechanical device like MRSA. So we're being very liberal. If they died of MRSA, we'll say they died of COVID.
So we're actually hastening their death by putting them on a ventilator.
There's no question about that. You would see a much reduced fatality rate if nobody was put on a respirator and you take your chances. I'll definitively prove that one day with a retrospective study, but I think everybody knows.
Here's the other thing, quickly, and then we'll move on. And that is, Medicare will pay $4,000 to a hospital for just a regular hospital admission. If that patient is diagnosed as having COVID-19, Medicare now pays $13,000. If they're placed on a ventilator, the hospital gets $39,000,
and
I'm not saying doctors are complicit in this, but hospital administrators
could be the administrator. Look, they're bankrupt, or they're nearly bankrupt. And now they're double bankrupt because nobody's going to the hospital. So, yes, they would be there would be temptation to put everybody on a respirator that's possible. And I can tell you, I had a couple people on a respirator and supposed to go on, and I helped them get off and go home. And that cost them about 50 cents a day. So you don't have to do a respirator.
So it looks like we can't really trust the data, number one. And number two, we may be making a huge mistake in the way that we're treating people.
Oh, yeah. And what about Cuomo's blunder? Just not only treating them medically, but socially, how we're interacting with the human race is not a pretty deal.
You're saying masks, bad idea.
One thing is the masks, but Cuomo actually took active COVID patients and transferred them to nursing homes. But you cannot go in and see your loved one. Active COVID patients in the ER in the different areas, but you can't go in and you're a healthy adult to see your loved one and help them pass over. This is the most ruthless example of modern medicine. I mean, the most revelation that you're going to block that your son from seeing the mother, your husband from seeing the wife from seeing the husband. They're not allowed in.
Yeah. No, this is heart-wrenching. When you think of there are small children, maybe cancer patients, and they're dying surrounded by, I know healthcare workers are wonderful and they're loving, but they're not the mom and dad. We have children dying basically alone.
Yes, that's happening. If they've been plungered with the COVID diagnosis, no one is allowed or we'll be, I was just told by a person, we can't go in, we'll be arrested, and we go to prison. That's the threat.
Yeah, that's to me is the most heart-wrenching aspect of this, the idea. And I know I've been to these, I hope this is an artifact that will be relegated to the dustbin of history. I went to attended my first Zoom funeral. Where no mourners are allowed at gravesite. They have a computer sitting near a headstone, and they video essentially the funeral. Zoom funerals. Okay, so let's talk. I've known you for probably a quarter century, as hard as that is to believe. And around that time, you had a book out called "The Cure Is in the Cupboard." And you talk about, or there's another one about, you know, in the supermarket, and we're talking about natural remedies, food, essentially, spices, herbs that can be used to combat certain pathogens.
Yes.
And ever since then, the establishment, Facebook, predictably, they've all really come down hard on you. Talk to me a little bit about what that's been like and from what quarters are you being attacked?
Well, for me, it's the medical establishment, industrial pharmaceutical. They don't want me to be in practice. So they basically destroyed my ability to be licensed. Now, that was through being set up with a private detective posing as a patient to try to get me to charge excessive fees, which I didn't, but whatever fees I charged was, I think, $1,000 for each patient, and there were two of them. They claimed that the fees were excessive and I didn't do a year analysis, and I should have, and I put the patient at risk, and all kind of stupidity. 38 counts. I had a heart attack. I knew I was going to lose my license. I recovered on my own without hospitalization. But what I did was I hired some private detectives posing as a patient to go on the board of medical examiners. And the medical examiners defrauded my private investigators. Well, this is while I was being prosecuted. So all of a sudden, when I put that data on the judge's counter, all of a sudden the counts went from 38 to 1. And the final count, for which I lost my 12 years of licensure work, you know, it took me 12 years to get to the license. Only 3 years to practice, and then I was done. Was he didn't get us the patient files in a timely manner, so he will irrevocably lose his license. You know, by that time I was so tired and sick of it. I just take it and stuff it. But, you know, in a sense, I'm happy because I learned, I wrote my books, and I started preaching about herbal medicine. So it was for a reason.
Right. And but even more recently, and we're going to talk about the new book, COVID-19, the COVID-19 Remedy. Yeah. And you've been...
I'm being attacked. Yeah.
Yeah, particularly because of... you are very enthusiastic about the oil of wild oregano.
Yes. The drug companies have hired a hitman, this silly professor. I didn't want to mention it. And he's got a video and different comments. He was given $5 million to go after what they call our quacks, right? So they've put the big focus on me because my work is a threat to industrial pharmaceutical. Huge. Monster threat. And so that's where they're focusing. And that's mainly my discovery of the oil of wild oregano. That's what they want to seem to undermine. You know, when Facebook trended my research on oil of oregano as an antiseptic here during this COVID outbreak, it went to 2,000 Facebooks in like 72 hours. And then Facebook was contracted to change the algorithm and to ditch it and dump it. And so now it's not trending anymore. Along with Google and Twitter, they all went against my work. New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post all went against this work so that people wouldn't research the data and find out they could actually do something about these epidemics and the threats to them and their loved ones. And so that's what I'm up against right now.
Was it the LA Times that said there's a special place in hell reserved for you?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what they were indicating, because they said that whoever this promoter is, he's trying to make a buck on oil of oregano. And he said anybody that does that deserves a special place in the hell. Yes, they did say it. You can see that published.
Well, we're going to head into a break here, Cass. But when we come back, we'll talk about several scientific studies that have looked at not only wild of oregano oil, but other spices and herbs, and how they dealt with a number of potentially deadly pathogens. We'll talk about that and more. Dr. Cass Ingram, his new book, The COVID-19 Remedy, right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Stay with us.
Exploring theories, uncovering facts, and offering a different view of the universe. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio. To speak with Richard live, call 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
Welcome back. Dr. Cass Ingram, my guest.
Yeah.
His brand new book, COVID-19 Remedy, The Real Truth Revealed. And, first of all, how do we get a copy of that book? Because is it still available for free?
Well, all your listeners are going to get the electric free.
The electric version is free.
Yeah, you know, we got to do something about this. I will have a hardback version, a book, and the book will be in May sometime. But this one, go to CassIngram.com and you download it. Get it while you can. CassIngram.com, there it is right there.
All right, and again, the electronic version is free. Well, for the time being anyway, but
so get it and spread it around, get everybody to get a copy and bind it up and you've got your book.
All right. I want to talk to you. We mentioned oil of oregano oil, and, talk to me about, there was a study done, and the lead scientist in the study actually went into the study intending to debunk the effectiveness of certain spice extracts and herbs.
I keep forgetting about all that it's been up against. Yes, Dr. F. Andron at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, coordinated by the federal government, before she even did the study, the objective was, there's somebody on the radio talking about oil of oregano, and he's written this book, The Cure is in the Cupboard. We got to hit him. So what we have to do is prove that he's a fraud so we can go after him and all of his... all of his work. So she said, look, my objective was just to take the oil of oregano, which was the P73, of course, and prove it was useless, that it would be a useless endeavor to use it, that it's not an antiseptic, that all of the commentary is fraudulent and fake. So she took it and put it in against deadly pathogens, and the oregano ate them up. She excoriated her lab tech, saying, you must have used chlorinated water. You got to go back and use the distilled water. It came back, and the oregano ate the socks off of these germs. She sent it a third time, a fourth time. Every time, the oregano, in a dilution of like 1 in 1,000, destroyed the germs.
And so
that's how hard it's been.
So we're talking about these pathogens. We're talking about things like E. coli, food poisoning. What other types
of... We don't know at first what she did because she did it secretly. Then, once they determined that it was effective, this is what they did. They sought to patent it. You see? This is the tyranny that you get, that the whole country's up against, all the whole world. So they took $450 million U.S. dollars, taxpayer money, with the objective of making a patentable drug. Because at the end of the research, Ms. Dron said, I'm a believer now. I think we should turn it into a drug. And what she did was, we kept tuna fish completely fresh for 60 days with the, I'm sure they used the P73, the oil of oregano. It was edible after 2 months. You know how tuna fish goes bad in 3 days.
Right.
And that, yes, they killed 9 deadly pathogens. That's true. But the spices weren't researched, just the oils. And they then researched 9 oils, and the most powerful one was the oregano oil, without doubt.
And what other, do we know what other pathogens were used in the study?
Yes, salmonella. They tested food poisoning molds. I believe Shigella was in the mix, Pseudomonas, and Staph was in that mix. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of pathogens.
Doesn't matter.
Anyway, oregano eats the pathogen. If it's a virus, it eats.
Was it a peer-reviewed study?
It's a significant study published in the Journal of Food Protection. It's a major journal. It was carefully designed. And it was funded to the tune of $450,000. That's a significant study.
Right. And you mentioned the tuna, because what they did with that is they created an edible sort of food wrap. I think originally it was with spinach, and we know spinach is very susceptible to things like E. coli, and it goes bad very quickly. So they were protecting the spinach using this edible coating. That was made out of what? From the oil of oregano?
Well, they put oil of oregano, cinnamon oil, because the cinnamon did pretty well in there. And you know, this was the USDA's ancillary research. What happened was USDA contacted me before this was published and said, hey, you know what? We want some of your oregano oil. Man, about 4 of them on the phone. I sent it to them. When they did their study, and they did 2 or 3 of these, they used tomatoes, they used spinach. They also made a disc, a film disc that they patented. They would put the cinnamon and the oregano oil in that disc so that they could use that disc for luncheon meats against listeria, to prevent staph, to prevent E. coli, to prevent whatever in vegetation as well. But that disc is made out of food. It's made out of pureed apples, pureed, and that's patented now. So that was the U.S. government scientists sought to profit from my work. At the same time, they did everything to prevent me from getting the word out to the public. That's the moral of what happened, because they asked for my cooperation, which I freely gave to them. And I'm doing that now. I'm saying, look, you've got the expert who started the whole industry right here that could stop this so-called pandemic. And put a stop to the deaths needlessly in the nursing homes, as well as the hospitals, as well as the people contracting the disease. So, it's been nothing but resistance.
Even though
the medical license to the research, and now this professor, all sorts of people being solicited to stop this guy. That's when I went up to Toronto, I met with the top distributor for natural supplements. And there was an arms dealer from Ottawa who they said I had to meet. He said, look, Dr. Ingram, we're taking over the oregano oil business. He was an Ottawa lobbyist, politician. here's my partner from overseas. You're going to be on the curb with a tin cup begging for change when we're done with you. That happened in 1999. I didn't get into this to get to fight with people. I mean, my job is above all do no harm and to help people come into life, help them pass through peaceably with free of disease, and help them ease them out. You know, it hurts me so much, Mr. Serrett, to see what's going on, to see what's happening in these people. No, you're not allowed to see your loved one. You can't do that to people. You will ruin them permanently. I wouldn't be surprised if the suicide rate goes up 500%.
That's right. They're giving us all these models that were faulty from this Professor Ferguson at the Imperial College. This was the guy that predicted mad cow disease would kill something like 200,000 people in the UK alone. It ended up killing 277. But here's the thing. I want to go back to the study for a moment, because this was a published study which showed oil of oregano a very effective in killing E. coli and different things like that. But it's an in vitro study, right? It's in a test tube or a petri dish.
This would be kind of an in vitro. It would have been inside the they would have put the bacteria into food and see if the oregano oil would work in that environment. It was in vitro. And the tuna fish is in vitro. My work on coronavirus, influenza, and bird flu was in vitro. But you know, these universities are compromised. The professors are scared. The doctors told me we're not going to do any research for you in humans because we'll be fired. We'll lose our job. We'll lose our privileges at the hospital. I've already been through this. It's difficult to get anybody to do the human work. But however, I'll tell you this. Because you might be listening and thinking, what about COVID, doctor? You're not mentioning. I have a human clinical trial going on now on my own where I have nurse practitioners, I have ex-drug reps, and I have a doctor who are giving their COVID-19 and their viral flu customers, they're giving them the oil of oregano, the sinuorega. I think the protocol is the oil of oregano, the juice, and oregaresp or the gel caps. Anyway, that's kind of... So I'm not speaking for the company, but I am doing this. I am sending what samples I have in my stock to the doctors, to the nurses, and the results are pretty spectacular. We'll get into it, but nobody's going to help. The government won't help, and the industrial pharmaceutical complex is fighting, resisting.
Okay, we have about a minute, and we'll talk about this more in depth on the other side of the break. But just in the next minute, just tell me a little bit about your studies with oil of oregano and wild oregano and bird flu,
so
etc.
I had a good Samaritan who gave, and I've got this written up in my case histories, who gave her neighbor, who was on a respirator, the oil of wild oregano. His wife or whoever rubbed it on his feet, 2 drops twice a day and 2 drops on his calves and shins. Within 2 days, the doctor yanked the respirator and said, your panels are so good, your profiles, no more respirator for you. Within 2 more days, he checked out of the hospital. He took only oil of oregano, no claims for any of the companies who make it. This is just me as a doctor in my book, and also this oregaresp material. That's what the health food store owner gave. Those 2 products only. I think neither, maybe one other. Here's another case. This was a person who was given, 17-year-olds, a potential death sentence. Instead, he got a hold of the oil of wild oregano super strength. He put it in a diffuser. He's a 17-year-old. And he was about to go to the hospital, but he kept inhaling every hour the diffused oil. And he took some capsules of the same. He did not go to the hospital. He did not get the double pneumonia. He did recover.
All right. I've got to take a time out. We'll come back. Dr. Cass Ingram, the COVID-19 remedy, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
The world is being pulled over your eyes. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett from Zoomer Radio. To reach Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
Hey, if you like The Conspiracy Show, you're going to love my podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited. New episodes drop every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And now there's Conspiracy Unlimited Plus. For just $1.99 per month, you can gain access to my vast back catalog of over 350 episodes. Plus, you get two commercial-free bonus episodes every month. Commercial-free. Just go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Get Access to Premium Episodes. Go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Get Access to Premium Episodes. Dr. Cass Ingram is here. His brand new book is The COVID-19 Remedy, and it is available for free as an electronic download from cassingram.com, CASSINGRAM. And you can just click on, if you go to strangeplanet.ca, click on Dr. Cass Ingram's name and it'll take you right to the website. And that's a free download for the time being until the book is published in hard copy. Now, we have to say a couple of things. First of all, you know, the old medical disclaimer, we can't say that this is a cure for anything. But
right.
It has shown in some studies that it is very effective against certain pathogens. You have done some of your own human trials. This is anecdotal, but
it
looks promising and it deserves further study. We can say that much. It deserves
I think we can
further
say that.
Study.
And I think we need to say that there's some data here. Oregano oil is 21 times more powerful as a phenolic compound than Lysol. So, you know, because you got Trump saying, can we do anything to clean these things out? You know, and the idea was at least all right. But no, I mean, you cannot take a synthetic and you cannot breathe chlorine. You can't put it on your skin. You'll burn and kill yourself. But the fact that it's 21 times more powerful than the synthetics that we're spraying on the streets has to be looked at. Right?
100%. So get back to that 17-year-old. You said he had a death sentence. Did he have a comorbidity that it was so serious?
He was an orphan and sort of malnourished and no father figure. His grandfather was sick with the COVID, and he didn't know that. He gave this child the sickness. The grandfather was in the hospital. He was about to join him. That was the situation. So they're going to put me on a respirator. That's what they're planning. And that's when a good Samaritan pitched him a couple products, dropped them off on the quarantine porch, and he took it. And it's a case we're writing up. A third interesting case, and all this, look, all we're saying is that we should look at this. This case was through a nurse practitioner, and she's a physical therapist. We have it written up. She was about to be intubated, and she said, I think I'm going to die. I saw the text. They don't want me to publish the text. They're afraid the hospital and the physical therapist will lose, you know, there'll be problems. So I'll publish the case history instead. The girl said, or the practitioner said, no, don't give up. And so she smuggled in a bottle of oregano bay leaf spray. The woman was instructed, and she sprayed it four times on the back of her throat. Her respiration improved so dramatically that the physician said, we will not intubate you. And within 72 hours, she checked out of the hospital. This is a physical therapist. This is no minor issue. You know, in terms of someone that knows. Her oxygen profile improved, and she eventually did not need any more oxygen. Now, I have 100 of these cases that we have to look at, some through a doctor, some through a nurse, some through myself, and they're all equally dramatic, some even more dramatic. And this is an interesting case of a guy who had double pneumonia, who was given prednisone and was told to go home, and there's nothing more we can do about it. And who has then said, I have to go back to the hospital, doctor. I really do. I think I'm going to die. So I said, why don't you do this? They're going to take you if they have to take you anyway. We're not going to interfere with that. But take the oil of wild oregano, something called super strength, and take 10 to 15 drops every half hour. He stopped the double pneumonia symptoms and the big pressure on the chest. It still stayed a bit, but he stopped the crisis. In 24 hours, the crisis was shut down. The fact that this is working within minutes to 24 hours, you have to look at it. You
right.
can't just keep beating up on it and making fun and belittling and and doing all sorts of scandalous attacks, the whole nation is shuttered.
Exactly.
I mean, the whole world.
We're in a war here, and in war you can't. You have to look at everything. We're in a desperate strait here. Yes. Listen, we'll take another time out. When we come back, I want to talk about your studies with wild of oregano oil and the bird flu and some other things, and we'll find out what happened. Cass Ingram, the author of COVID-19 Remedy, back with more in a moment right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away.
Where there's smoke, there's The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio.
We are back with Dr. Cass Ingram, the COVID-19 remedy available as a free electronic download at cassingram.com. And it's available for free for a short while. So make sure you get your download. Again, just go to strangeplanet.ca and click on Dr. Cass Ingram's name. That'll take you right to the website. Then just download the book. The electronic version for free. It'll be available as in hard copy form very soon. So you did your own in vitro studies with wild of oregano oil and things like the bird flu, which is very, very deadly, potentially.
Oh, extremely deadly. And think about this. What's going to happen to our society if bird flu breaks out, which migrates from person to person? If it becomes virulent enough that it can infect from you to two or three others, and on it goes, it's 60% fatal, right? So I wasn't that interested in bird flu, but what we did was an in vitro study published in Antiviral Research in Abstract Form and presented before the peers, where we took the bird flu and influenza A as well as the human coronavirus and infected it in cell culture. So that gives me 5 million viruses per every centimeter of fluid and cells. That's a lot of viruses, 5 to 10 million. So then I can put in something. I could put in chlorine. I could put in isopropyl alcohol. I could do whatever. Instead, we put in oil of wild oregano. So we have an intracellular virus now. It's not just a petri dish. And it obliterated 99.99% in 2 minutes of these 5 million per centimeter of blood. So we have, say we have a billion viruses that went down to basically nothing. By 20 minutes, it went down to 150 dead, basically dead viruses. In other words, the viruses could not regrow. As long as you kept some oregano oil in the medium, nothing. That's one dose in 20 minutes, by the way. So then we did the same with influenza. We had 10 million viruses per centimeter of blood. We gave the oil of wild oregano super strength. And we also used something that you know and we both take called Oregaresp, which is cumin, oregano, sage, and cinnamon. So we gave both. And the Oregaresp in the coronavirus, by the way, it reduced it not to 150, but to zero. So there was non-detectable. It seemed that this multiple spice worked a little quicker than even the oil of oregano, but they're both good. Okay. So in this case, we dropped it to 99.99% in 2 minutes and to virtually nothing by the 20 minutes. So now you've got the bird flu, right? I mean, that's going to be different than something that's 0.01% fatal or 1% fatal for corona, I guess. But this was the human corona. It wasn't the same. But this doesn't make that much difference. But bird flu, we know, is 50 to 60%. So they came to me and they said, it didn't work. I said, what do you mean it didn't work? I said, what kind of a dose did you use? Oh, the same. The same dose for flu? And this is 1,000 times more fatal? I said, yes, put 25 times the dose. And it worked. 99.99% destruction in 2 minutes. What does that mean? That means that if you keep making fun of natural medicine instead of looking into it, if the bird flu broke out, the whole world would be done. We're finished. Because we've made so much fun, belittled, pushed down, propagandized, look, you know what God says? Hey, man, you don't believe in God, that's okay. I feel sorry for you, but I happen to think it's a good idea. He says in the Old Testament, look, I'm not a scripture expert. It says something about cleaning yourself out with hyssop, which is from the Hebrew Esau. It only means wild oregano. It doesn't mean anything else. So there's only one recommendation anywhere in a scripture for an herb, a specific herb, to be using it. And it's the oregano in the mountains. Wild oregano, clean. Trump wasn't too far off.
Right, right. What is it about wild oregano, the oil? What is the active ingredient?
It's the phenolic carvacrol, thymol, small amount, and terpenes, various terpenes. There are about 30 different ones. They're all antiseptic. There's two mechanisms of action. One is that it cleans things. It actually will our work showed that it disintegrated the viruses. That's like cleaning. So it destroys those little spicules, for example, on corona. It destroys the shell of the capsid of the virus. It destroys the cell wall of the bacteria, and the guts leak out, and then it eats the guts. It's like an eating agent. The second mechanism is it induces the immune system to do a better job at cleaning pathogens. The third is interesting. It's anti-cytokine. You know that cytokine storm that leads to so much trouble with the flu or with double pneumonia?
That's the immune system attacking itself, attacking the
basically
body.
Basically, it's an overreaching immune system. And the explosiveness of the germ with the immune system, and the body cannot defeat the inflammation quick enough, and they check out. And that's a gene. And the gene is turned down 50 to 70% by the oregano. Can you imagine? Just take a little tube that you have, a little cathode ray tube radio. You turn that down to just a little whisper. Then you could survive.
Right.
Black seed oil does it too.
Black seed oil.
Human, yeah, they do. You know, we need to do something. I've got the black seed miracle. We talked before, but that's a powerful lung maintenance supplement. You know, that the two together would be indivisible or undefeatable.
Right. You mentioned the spicules, and this is the part of the coronavirus from which it gets its name, because it looks like a crown, and that's what corona is. So these spicules, that's like the key that unlocks the door allowing the virus entry into our cells, correct?
That is correct. That is, if without the spicules, it's even if the rest of the cell is there, it's a dead duck. It can't do anything.
So it is killing the spicules. It's destroying
oregano
them.
Oregano oil eats the spicules. Cinnamon oil does too. This is not bay leaf oil eats. These essential oils, they melt those spicules. They're done. The whole thing is finished. If we could just popularize an antiseptic spray with oregano base, bay leaf would be great. The two together are pretty powerful. They're both, remember, the Greeks used to wear that wreath on their heads. Why do you think they did that? To protect them from, that's the bay leaves, to protect them from plague. It wasn't just a spiritual thing. And so if we could popularize something like that in the subways, in the airplanes, if we could popularize oil of oregano as a preventive, this would be done. We would interrupt the viral transmission, and we would be back to normal. But we need to popularize in the nursing homes and in the hospitals, the front line. You know?
And in the meantime, you could use it, I'm guessing, as a cleaner to spray sinks.
Oh, you could.
Things. Yeah,
you could either put the oil in, or you're better off to get the actual spray. It's called Orega spray to help your listeners, and you can dilute it 10 to 1 with water. And then use it around the house, 5 to 1. For your own personal use, you can use it full strength, like the woman that was laying there that was going to get intubated. And here's what I'm astonished from, though, more than these two mechanisms. How could several of these people get dramatically better from 2 drops under the tongue twice a day or 3 times a day? How? There's an energy. This is a filth vaccine, maybe, you know, most likely pig or whatever. It's a filth disease lab. It's filthy. It's garbage. And, you know, Wuhan market, I don't care. And you're giving something from the highest energy. So it's energy. It's a soul. It's a miracle energy that something mountain grown where nothing else can grow on the rock. You extract its essence. So it's doing something we don't understand. It's resetting the body for these people. It's allowing the body to function. No one will be able to figure out this thing.
Well, we're not saying it's the cure. We're saying it deserves to be researched and looked into, and based on your anecdotal and sort of limited, we have to say that, human trials, yes. It is showing tremendous promise.
And I quote the case histories in the book. I'll quote more. They're legitimate. They're accurate. I have some individual cases where the person wrote me a letter on my website You've got to do something to look at this world. You can't just deny that this is in the Old Testament to sort of warn people. Why do you think it's there? You know, pork flesh is also warned against, right? So you're going to ignore it all and let the world shut down and let the let people start punching themselves out in the street, which you're already doing. And the one guy got shot because he told somebody they should wear a mask. They whipped out a six-shooter and shot him in the head, killed him at a convenience store. I mean, you know, this is enough.
Enough, indeed.
Put an end to it, and I know how to do it.
The COVID-19 remedy, go to CassIngram.com, download your free electronic version while it lasts. Dr. Cass Ingram, always a pleasure. Thank you for this.
You betcha. Bye now.
Dr. Al Proffitt is next to discuss his career in paranormal investigation. Stay with us. Stay with us into hour two of The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett.
Live from Toronto, Canada, Earth, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio.
Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed rec room with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Dr. Al Proffitt is with us this hour to discuss some of his paranormal investigations, haunted houses, a haunted battleship, and one supposed possessed individual. Dr. Proffitt is a recently retired professor from the University of North Carolina system. He's lived in the Appalachian Mountains his entire life and was born and raised in the southern coal fields of West Virginia. He graduated with a bachelor's degree and a master's degree from Marshall University. He earned his doctorate from West Virginia University in 1990. He's been a professor in three universities, superintendent of schools in two states, a school principal, guidance counselor, assistant principal, teacher, and coach. He's an award-winning singer-songwriter and has appeared on stage with American jazz icons Dizzy Gillespie and James Moody. In his senior year of high school, he was offered but turned down an apprenticeship with the American Wind Symphony Orchestra. He studied the psychical sciences since completing his high school project on ghosts. Dr. Al Proffitt, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
I am doing very well, Richard, and I hope you are as well.
Likewise. You have had, to say the least, a varied career in music, in education, and in the paranormal, and some might find those intersections rather unusual. Talk to me about how that came to be, education and the paranormal.
Yeah. Okay, well, you know, I guess as so many paranormal investigators say, they were raised in a haunted house, and the same would be said for me. So I had that experience, and I had parents who didn't try to tell me that I was crazy, but they had experiences as well, and they taught me two basic lessons with this, and the first one has always been important and a central part of my life, is that you treat everybody with dignity and respect, regardless of their skin, regardless of their religion, regardless of anything about them, and to extend that to the paranormal realm as well. So I've never been someone who would try to provoke or, you know, I've heard of people like going somewhere and urinating on a grave. And to me, you know, I just don't think that there's any excuse for that. So anyway, I had that. And then as I was coming through high school, we had to write a major project, as so many do. And so kind of, you know, tongue in cheek, I went and told one of my teachers that I'd like to write on ghosts. And there was a committee of teachers, and I told her not only did I want to write on ghosts, I wanted three of my friends to work with me on the paper. So she said, well, she would see and get back to me. So she talked with the other students involved, who were three top-notch students. And she then brought me back into her office, and she told me that if I thought that telling her a few ghost stories was going to be a high school project, that was not it. And she taught, she actually made sure that I learned certain things that I was still using when I studied my doctorate. One was the scientific method, and one was serious research. So we had to find that place that had the reputation of being haunted and stay there. you know, maybe overnight, get permission and all that kind of thing. You know, we're still in school. And so I did that, and we come up with absolutely nothing at that place. But that would change once I graduated from school. But anyway, you know, there was a couple things that in education, you switch over from the paranormal. One of the things that they taught me there was the scientific method. And the other thing that they taught me was the value in working as cooperatively as you could with other people. So it was like peer learning together and using the scientific method. And honestly, those are skills that I used all through college, through my bachelor's, my master's, and then especially my doctorate. So I owe them a debt that I don't think I'll ever be able to repay. But the house that we investigated when I was a senior, when we actually would start to go back there, it became a place. It was maybe 25, 30 miles from us, and it was in a state park. And it was actually the first settlement of this area of that county. And so it became a really good place for us to camp. And, you know, we had shelter from, you know, it was a three-story house. We had shelter from rain and that kind of stuff. The radio was remarkably clear because there was nothing around it as far as any electricity and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, a lot of people will say, when I'm leading up to this, well, I bet you all were doing all kinds of mind-altering things. And we weren't. We were doing zero mind-altering things. And, but we were there. There were four of us there. It was one night. And, you know, one of the things about studying the paranormal as well, I feel, is that so much of it is you're going to, you know, people are not going to believe you, and there's no way that you can prove it. Or people are going to believe it and, you know, and don't even listen to reason on the other side. But anyway, there were four of us, and we had returned. And this was the summer, I think, that I'd graduated from high school. And we were staying there. And we always took our stuff up to the third floor. And we took probably what was a bedroom. And there was no furniture or anything like that. So we had sleeping bags. We had the old Coleman lantern with the mantle. And we had a radio with us that, you know, just like, yeah, I know it might be hard for some of the kids to understand today, but radio was our link to the world, FM radio and AM. And we had it on the strongest signal that we could get, or the strongest station. And it was out of Richmond, Virginia, and they were playing classical music, which basically we all liked. We were rock and rollers, but we liked that classical music as well. And so also had a tape recorder that was battery driven. And by that time, we were just fooling around. This was a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and this is one of the things that I will pat my teachers on the back for, too. They told me that I had to have more ways to do this, so I saved up and got to record to see if you offer some proof. And so we recorded hours of stuff up there, but by that time, we were just, you know, we were talking over it and the whole thing. But anyway, this was the sequence of events that happened. And this was my first experience with the paranormal outside of my own home.
This is West Virginia, correct?
This was in West Virginia, yes.
Right. And let me just ask you, how did your parents feel, all of your parents, feel about you going and spending a night in a haunted house?
Well, my parents didn't mind it at all. They thought that they had trained me fairly well, you know, to be respectful. And they also had experience at that time. I was also playing in somewhat of a regionally popular rock and roll band. So they were not used. They were used to me being gone, you know, the entire weekend, you know, because we would just stay where we could. It was the very best possible job, you know, after school summer job that a high school kid could have, is being a drummer for a rock and roll band. And so they were kind of used to that. The other parents, I think, sort of trusted my parents that if I was going to stay there, it must be okay.
Okay.
And my parents knew these three guys real well.
Right. So let me ask you also, the reputation of this haunted house, what was the reputation?
The reputation, that's a great question, Richard. The reputation was that the house had been abandoned, and it had been somebody very wealthy had owned it, the Bowers family. But anyway, that there was these hunters that were on the property, and they were hunting after the home had been abandoned, and they had a child with them. It was two grown men, and I guess they were, you know, in West Virginia, that was not unusual because we were taught, you know, how to hunt and all that sort of thing. So they had him there. So when they went in to the home, I don't know if it was as a joke or whatever, and this is just as folk legend anyway, but they put him in a room that was under the stairs, and they locked him in there. And throughout the evening, he was screaming, "Please, there's something in here with me. Please let me out. Please let me out." And as you can guess, they didn't. And as legend have it, when they opened up the door, the young man had clawed both of his eyes out and bled to death through his eye sockets.
Oh, my.
And, yeah, so, you know, that's, and I remember that because we had to get background and talk to people to get that story of people who knew of the house. And that was a part of my training as well. And, but yeah, so that's what we were expecting to find was the ghost of this little boy. And I don't know really if we ever experienced the little boy or not.
Did you capture EVPs on tape?
No. And here's the thing though. At that point, I didn't really know much about EVPs. As a matter of fact, I didn't know anything about EVPs to where there's no sound. And then you pick up something on the recorder. We did not know that. And this is well before the, you know, the internet and everything that we could get to study. It had to be, you know, either a book that we bought when we went to a more urban area or what our library had. So the tape recorder was there to record things that we would hear. That everybody would share and everybody would be able to hear that. I don't know. Does that make sense?
You didn't understand at the time, and who did, that you would have to play it back and listen through hours of tape because EVPs, as we now know, aren't necessarily audible to the human ear live. You have to listen back.
Exactly. I don't think that I have ever picked up an EVP that I heard live. You know, it was always you listen back to it, and you're right. If you do an investigation that goes over, you know, a day or two, there is a lot of film to watch. There is a lot of audio to listen to. And, you know, I remember I was talking to Lloyd Auerbach once, and he told me that he basically had given up using video because of the tremendous amount of time that you spend. And you can't fast forward through it. You have to watch it, you know, at its speed. And then if you see something, then you slow it down and all those things. So it that made a lot of sense to me. And I guess it got to the point that I didn't take as much video after that either because he was right. And it did take a ton of time to do that. But we didn't know that as kids, you know, when we're 17, 18 years old. And so we were I remember we were listening to the station in Richmond, Virginia, very clear. And we had the a Coleman lantern going. And for people that might not remember a Coleman lantern, it was, you know, you put a little propane or whatever in the bottom, a little oil, actually, not propane, heating oil. And then it would heat this mantle. It was really quite bright, and you had to pump it, you know, sometimes to keep it there. But it was really, really bright, causing no problems whatsoever. And so one of our friends was pretty much a comedian, and he was going through one of his routines or doing something, I can't even remember. And we were basically just having a good time. And by this point, honestly, we had given up on finding ghosts there. We were just going through the motions, but we were just having a good time. You know, it was the summertime and we were getting ready to scatter all our different ways. And so we were just kind of having, you know, that nice, you know, just opportunity. And again, we were not drinking. At that time, we'd never even heard of marijuana. At least, you know, if we did, it was on the 6:30 news, and it was just, you know, a scourge of the devil and all that stuff. So we really were not using that. And we had, you know, even though this place would become so, and still is so damaged by the opioid crisis but there was none of that. So that's to say that we were all in our clear minds, and at least the three of them were pretty intelligent. And so we were laying there, and two of them, two of the guys were laying down in their sleeping bag and just listening to the nonsense that was going on. And actually, I was beginning to bed down too, but the tape recorder just stopped. And I knew they would put really fresh batteries in it, so I got up and fooled with it, and I got it to going again. So we continued on with the nonsense, and then it stopped again. I did the same thing, and then it stopped for the third time. And when it did, these things happened. And this is one of those things, oh, believe it if you will. And I'm to the point that I'm no longer really caring if people believe it, because I was there and it happened to me, and I would have many other things happen to me throughout my career with this. But anyway, the tape recorder quit, the radio faded out, and the front door slammed. I'm not talking about it closed. It slammed, and just as it did that, the Coleman lantern faded down. So now we've lost a Coleman lantern, which is not electric. We've lost a tape recorder and a radio, which both were run by batteries. And so we're in the total dark, and then we hear heavy footsteps. And could we have been punked? You know, I guess anything's possible, but we were way out in nowhere and with this place. And we heard the steps coming up, and it came up the first flight of steps and stopped. And then just as soon as it stopped, the lantern came back on, the tape recorder came back on, and the radio came back on. And so now we're at this point, we've heard the door slam, and that there's somebody or something that has walked up to the first flight. So that means in order for us to get out, we're going to have to go by that, you know. And at that point, there was no question as to whether or not we were going to go out. We were leaving. So it took us three trips to get everything up there. That's how comfortable we'd come there, carrying coolers and all that kind of stuff. And we threw everything that wouldn't break out toward the truck, out of the third floor window. And so what we did then is that we had all the other stuff, and we kind of huddled. It looked like kind of a cartoon. We kind of huddled together and went down the steps together just as fast as we possibly could, not stopping to look around and see if we could find some stuff. And it was, quite frankly, one of the most scared that I've ever been. And, you know, I've really tried not to let the paranormal scare me too bad. And this kind of helped, that it would help me get over that type of fear.
Let me ask you, Alvin. So just because, sure, you know, we're coming up on the break here in a few minutes, how did you do on that term paper that you had to write?
Oh, we got an A. We did. I mean, we did real well. We had one of us was the researcher writer, and one of us was an interviewer, and we did break it up, and we did real well, and I was very pleased with that. I just wish that I still had a copy of that thing.
Just before the break here, let me ask you quickly. Backing up to your childhood, you grew up in a haunted house. So tell me about what that house was like.
Okay, it was, oddly enough, it was built by my parents in 1960, and we'd lived maybe 5 or 6 miles away from it. And the site that they chose and they were able to buy was actually exactly on the same spot as the first person who settled in the county, which was Wyoming County, West Virginia. It was John Smith, and we were right exactly on the same spot. And, you know, they worked land and all those sorts of things. So it was a new house that we had built. There was no standing structure there. So it's kind of hard to explain as to why a brand new house would be haunted, but I hear that story, you know, several times. I've heard it several times since then. And what we didn't know, but there was a big barn that was right across the road. When I say road, I'm talking about a dirt road, and it was right across from us. And what we did not know is that there was a burial ground that was right there. And this was also a place where the Algonquin Indians would come to hunt. They didn't live there because of the rugged terrain. It's really, really rugged in southern West Virginia. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's quite beautiful. It's quite striking, but it's very rugged as well. And so there was somebody that bought a house and was going to build a house beside. They were going to tear down the barn and build them a house there. And then they realized there were graves there. And I remember as a kid watching the excavation folks come in and take those caskets away that they would dig up. And some of them, we say caskets, they were buried, 150 years ago, maybe, and they were buried in a pine box. So sometimes they were taking big scoops of dirt, which I'm assuming had bones and that sort of stuff in it. So that's the only way that we could think of as to why it may have been haunted. And listen, there was other reasons that, we've really never discovered. But it was really interesting, and it was not frightening. This is, as a matter of fact, this is not very original on any part of my family, but we referred to the ghost as Casper. Okay, Casper, the friendly ghost. And I think that was part of my parents giving me a very friendly face on something that was paranormal. And, I was told to respect it, and those sorts of things, which I did. But we grew up, we had, for example, the most consistently haunted thing that we had is that we had a rocking chair. And where the rocking chair actually comes down into the rocker part, I'm not really sure what you call those, where it rocks back and forth on the wood that's curved. And as you would rock back, it would come out of the hole that the chair was attached to, but the other three would hold tight. And then when you would rock forward, it would snap back in, and you could hear it. And we heard that night after night after night, and you'd walk in the room, nothing, no movement in the chair, no more sounds. And as a matter of fact, back in the day, when they made me go to bed early, I'm basically a night person, but they were struggling with that. But we would just listen and it would start. And one of my parents, usually my mother, would yell out, "There goes Casper." And so it was kind of actually we did get kind of, I did anyway, kind of a warm feeling from having, I was an only child and sort of become a brother that I never had or a sister that I never had. And there were many other things. Like we was laying in bed one night, at least I was, and there was this tremendous crash. I mean, it sounded like every pot and pan that we had in the house had just been dumped all at once into the kitchen. And so I got up. This is one of those things, we were still trying to catch it if we could and see it. And so we went down there and I found my father was already there. And we just looked at each other. There was nothing, absolutely nothing out of place. And it was a loud, loud crash. So anyway, to this day, we haven't been able to figure out what that is.
Dr. Alvin Proffitt will share some more of his paranormal experiences and investigations right here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away.
Big Brother is listening, and so are you. To The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. To speak with Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free 1-866-740-4740.
We are back with Dr. Alvin Proffitt. And you were talking about your childhood home, which was located adjacent to an Indian burial ground. And you were sharing some experiences. So you had, I think, one more to add.
Yeah, there's just one more. My mother was a successful beautician and, I guess, entrepreneur. She did have a beauty shop that was inside our house. And, sometimes in this particular area, we would get pretty substantial snows. And we were in one of those. It was falling. I was just as thrilled as I could be because there was no school and all that. And so I was just watching TV in the house. And my mother came in, and she didn't really joke around about things like this, but she said, "I want you to get the largest knife you can find, and I want you to search the house." And she said, "I'll tell you why in a minute." So I checked under the bed, checked everywhere, didn't find anything. And then what had happened was that she was working on one lady's hair, and she was still expecting one more to come in, and they had a divider in the room, and they heard the sliding glass door. It opened, and it shut, and both she and the other customer spoke to the person they assumed that it was, and there was nothing that, nobody said anything back. There was no sound, so she stepped around, and there was no one there. But when she went to the door, there were footprints that came up the sidewalk and come in to the door, and then left the door and went out in the yard maybe 20 feet and just stopped. And so you could go and you saw at the very beginning of where the sidewalk started, you could see that just like somebody had gotten out of a car But you could see the footprints and in the snow coming up there and then walking away. And so, but we never was able to figure it out.
I wanted to jump ahead and talk to you about the U.S. Coast Guard. You were vetted and you were given clearance to study paranormal events on the battleship U.S. North Carolina in Wilmington. First of all, how does one approach the U.S. Coast Guard to get permission, and what sort of vetting did you go through?
Well, you know, I'm not 100% sure what they actually did or how they vetted me, but the way that it started is that there was a man by the name of Danny Bradshaw, and he's written a book on the haunted USS North Carolina, because he was there. He was, in essence, its caretaker and night watchman. I mean, he lived on the boat. And he would tell me things, you know, in the interview, like, sometimes it gets so bad that I go out and I sleep in my car, but I sleep at the beginning where the tourists come in so nobody can get by me. But anyway, so I talked to him and asked him if I could have permission. He said, well, he wasn't at a place that he could give me permission. So, and I'm forgetting the ranks, and he gave me names and numbers of people that I should call. And finally, I reached a high enough echelon, I guess, within the system of the National Guard. And I'm not sure if it was a captain. I really, truly do not remember. But anyway, that came back through. He called me and said, you got it. You've been vetted and you're okay. You can come in. So I went over the first night and Mr. Bradshaw was there and it was lit up. Oh, I mean, it was just beautiful. It's just one of these things. It's gorgeous. And, you know, my father served in the Navy and was in the entire theater in the Pacific when we were fighting World War II and on an aircraft carrier. He served on an aircraft carrier. So I had heard stories, you know, about that. And so this is like a kid's dream come true. I mean, it's just two of us on this entire battleship. And so we were, and it was just lit up. I mean, it was like they had lights everywhere, lights on down deck and, you know, up on the deck. And so we were walking around and he said, well, come on, I'll take you down here. So tourists don't come here, but let me show you down here. And we were walking down and we began to hear things. When I say things, I don't know what they were, but it was metal on metal. And then we heard footsteps and he just looked at me and he said, you see? And then he said, well, come on, we'll pay attention to that, but come on, I'm going to show you something. And then we began to take a few more steps, his light began to go out. And then he looked at me, he said, you know, when this happens, I turn around. And he said, and that's what I'm going to do, you can go if you want to. I turned around with him, and we walked back. And then I just interviewed him, and we sat. You know, we would go up into where the actual captain was when they were piloting the ship. And he said, well, why don't you come back tomorrow night and we'll do it a little bit more for real. So I said, okay. So we came back and I'm driving up into the parking lot, a massive parking lot. This is a major tourist attraction as well. And there's no lights on whatsoever on the battleship except for one little portal, one of those little round windows, I guess, portal. And I walked up and Danny met me at the beginning of the steps and he said, I got it ready for you tonight. And then he said, I'm not going with you. You have the boat to yourself. And just think, just as a kid, though, I mean, now I'm given the chance to be on a battleship, for goodness sakes. You know, that's enough for the kid in me, the Walter Mitty inside of me. So I'm up and I have all the equipment I've got. I've got, you know, I've got two rather large bags I'm carrying. I'm setting up meters and I'm setting up, you know, just whatever I had at that particular time, the cameras and the meters. And then I got my flashlight and I grabbed one of the bags, which would had recorders and that. And so I was headed down and I began to go down the steps. You're going straight down from one deck to another deck to another deck. And I was down six, maybe seven decks. And it was just so exciting to me. And then all of a sudden, no warning. It didn't, my flashlight just went out completely. It didn't fade. It just went out. Now, if you're six decks down in a battleship, there is no source of light unless you have electricity. And there's no electricity. So the only source of light that I had was my equipment. And I thought, well, okay, I can use one of my cameras had a light on it that like it would highlight what it is that you were going to shoot. So I went and it didn't work. And then as I went through and I'm doing this in the dark and I'm trying to find things, nothing worked. Absolutely nothing worked. And except for one little thing, and that was a little bitty flashlight, keychain flashlight that my daughter had given me. And I just out of hope, it was on my keys, and I pushed that, and that light came on. It was a very, very, very little bit of light. So I just made sure again with that light, there's nothing going to work. Nothing did work. So now I'm thinking, if this thing goes out, I'm in a world of hurt, because cell phones do not reach anywhere. They do not come out of this, all this metal and stuff. And they told me that. Danny told me, you will find yourself that if you get in trouble on the boat, we won't be able to find you until the morning in all likelihood. We won't even look for you probably, because we'll still think you're doing your thing. And the dangerous part of that is not necessarily a ghost or something paranormal. If you were walking along, just all of a sudden you come into where those stairs, I mean, the ladders go down and in the hatchways, you would fall, there's nothing but metal. It would be pretty much be a death fall. I just can't see any other way around that.
Right, right.
But anyway, so I had everything on me, and I finally did find where I could start my climb back up. And I got up to about the second deck, and things began to start coming on again. It was just the weirdest thing. And this is one of the things that made me believe I may never be able to prove this experience to anybody. But I know what happened, and did I make any of it happen? No. I am thankful to be out of there without hurting myself, seriously. So that was, in addition to the fun I was having and being on a battleship all by myself, that just really was one of the most enlightening things that I've ever had happen to me.
Aside from the lights going out and your equipment not working, and I presume the batteries were all charged and ready to go, was there any other unusual activity? Did you capture any other evidence?
Now, I was still shooting video at that time, and I had a video recorder that was set up in the captain's, or the command deck, and they said that was probably the most haunted place on the boat. And you could hear sounds, but nothing that was, that really sounded ominous, or it just like pops and cracks. And so I took it back over and I let Danny hear that and see that. And he said, I hear that all the time and we cannot explain it, except in that hatchway that I'm talking about, there was an orb. There was actually two orbs that as you look down, and I took the picture that way, that were there. One was beyond the ropes. They had, in certain places, they had safety nets, not ropes, safety nets that would catch someone if they fell. And I took one of those that had an orb under it and then an orb above it. And as well, and I know that there's a real debate in orbs doesn't mean anything, because they are simply droplets of water and specks of dust and, things like that. Snow, anything like that is captured and it comes back as an orb, especially dust. And, and most, I think, paranormal investigators buy into that. Certainly the camera companies buy into that. But there are some things that you can't explain, because imagine as you're taking flash photography, that digital flash photography, and you have one of those orbs that actually has a trail on it. Do you imagine how fast that piece of dust had to be going to make a trail? I mean, because it's just like, 1/500th or once in a second, 1/500th of a second that the flash goes on and off, and the aperture opens and closes. And so I never really did buy into it. I'm one of the few holdouts that thinks that, there's a little bit more here than meets the eye, and we should maybe pay a little more attention to those as we could.
Got to jump in here, Alvin. We're going to take another time out. We'll come back and we'll talk about the time you were recruited by a major church denomination to investigate possible demonic activity. Right here on The Conspiracy Show, my name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away.
PIN numbers, passcodes, social insurance numbers. If they make you wonder how private they are, here's two more numbers. 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
Dr. Elvin Prophet stays with us. I understand you were involved in an exorcism at one time, or kind of an exorcism. Tell me about that.
Well, I saw a man that I thought might be demonic but I was not going to, or maybe would had some evil entity attached to him, and I wasn't about to tell him that I can get rid of that. I said, you might need to seek a higher authority on this. And then anyway, I got a call from his wife one night, and she said, you got to please, please help him. He's in the closet. He's not referring to himself by his right name, and he's saying he's going to kill himself. And will you please talk him down? And so she took the phone in, and Richard, it was like talking to somebody that I'd never seen before. And he was referring to his name as he was a German. He had transformed himself into a German. And, you know, maybe Nazi, maybe not. I'm not sure. But at any rate, I began to talk to him, and I couldn't. So then I did something that's very uncharacteristic of me. I said, I want to talk to the entity that's inside of you. And things begin to change. And finally, I said, I'm not going to try to talk anybody out of, you know, I'm not going to try to do an exorcism. But anyway, I got to the point that I was afraid for his life. I was afraid he had a lovely family. And I was afraid there was going to be some harm. So I said, I want to speak to that entity. Voice changes. The intonation of his words changed. And then after talking to that, you know, for him for a while, I finally said, I demand that you come out of him and leave this family alone. And basically, I heard the phone drop and silence. And then he got back on and he said, well, I'm in the closet. Why am I in the closet? And I thought, well, I got the guy back. But I never, you know, in some ways, I heard the phone crackle. And I was just thinking, what if that thing came into me? I don't want to be the priest in The Exorcist where I grab hold of it and jump out the window.
Exactly. Let me just get a quick take from you on this. And that is the idea that from a religious standpoint, Christians and other denominations or other religions may also believe that there's no such thing as ghosts or spirits. What we are witnessing are sometimes referred to as familiars. It's part of a demonic deception. In other words, there are yes. There are no hauntings. There are only demonic deceptions. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, first of all, I find that interesting for this reason, and I'll have to actually give Joshua Warren, the credit for this. I was doing actually one of his shows with him at one time back when we used to associate and work with each other. And during one of the breaks, he told me, he said, you know, I don't understand that Christians have a hard time believing in the paranormal because the Bible is the most paranormal book that's ever been written. And he's absolutely right about that. He talks about witches. He talks about ghosts. Now, but it doesn't say demons that are ghosts. It says ghosts. And so my thinking on that is that if that there is so much, you know, they also say we're alone in the universe, which I just can't even fathom that from any direction. You know, if we are God's best work, he probably just should let us be a draft and try it again. I mean, because we have a whole lot of weaknesses as human beings. I do especially. But anyway, I would say to those people is that, you know, I'm studying life after death. That's what I'm studying. And that's what you proposed. That is true. We either go to heaven or we go to hell, but it is life after death. And I said, I'm trying to establish that in a scientific method. And it would not do anything to my faith or my faith if I was able to actually sit down and have an apparition talk to me. It would not diminish my faith in that. It just means that God's big enough to, as you're dealing with the whole universe, that he could also deal with different dimensions. And maybe when we die, we go to a different dimension. I don't have any idea. I'm not afraid of death, but I don't want to welcome it either. So my response to him, I think, would just be that, you know, just because that there's something you don't understand, that doesn't mean that it's demonic. Something that I think is demonic is where you might have two school guys get automatic weapons and go in Columbine High School and blow people away. And that I would, you know, we could talk some evil there and, you know, and all the other things, the kid at Parkway. I mean, we could just go through all that sort of stuff. But anyway, I think that in studying this, that Christians would be kind of interested in the fact. And, you know, there's a lot of Christians that are interested. You know, as a matter of fact, I have a whole lot of people when I finally, after Our State Magazine, run a actually a 4 or 5 page article on me. I had no choice but just to come out and say, yep, that's what I do. My colleagues around me already knew that. And some think it's just weird. Others, but you would think not, but you'd be surprised at the people that will come to you and say, now, you don't think I'm crazy, but, and then they tell you this. And that just sort of, I take some comfort in that. And, you know, I don't really necessarily think of anybody as crazy. I was taught not to do that as well. Maybe they operate in a different manner than I do. But I think that would be my response to that, is that the Bible is the most paranormal book you can get.
Very well put. All right, Alvin, we'll take one final time out, come back, and talk about some of the places of renown that you've been fortunate enough to investigate, including Loch Ness, Oxford University, the Devil's Stair Steps in North Carolina. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
Providing the evidence and letting you draw your own conclusions. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett on Zoomer Radio.
We are back with Dr. Alvin Prophet. Lest people think that your investigations have been limited or restricted to Appalachia, you have traveled the globe. Tell me about, for example...
And we went to Scotland. And if I may interject this is one of my thrills of life, too. We went to where there were ghost tours that were going through the underground in Edinburgh, and people might not know what I'm talking about. It's not like underground as in the rock underground or the English underground. It was actually catacombs where people lived during the days of the bloodshed and, you know, of all that was going on in Scotland and Edinburgh at the time. And these people lived their whole lives down there, some of them never seeing the sun. And it was something that I had studied but not really appreciated until actually I took the first tour. And I went to the tour people and I said, you know, I'm an investigator and I'd like to take a look at this. And they said, well, we can't let you be in there by yourself, but what you can do is you get between tours and you can follow one out of their sight, and before the other comes, when you hear them coming, you do that. So I did that on my first night. And the next night, I came up and I talked to them again. They said, well, listen, why don't you join the last tourist group that's coming through? You can be, we will let you be the last person out. And as long as you promise to close and lock the door, I swear to goodness, it sounds like, you know, you're going to grandmama's house, but make sure you lock the door when you leave. And just the magnitude of that, once everybody was gone, the silence and the dark and the history that just went on around me. And I was taking pictures and I got some extremely good light activity, which I mean beams of light that are shooting down. And that was not at all present when, you know, that I saw, but you would see that it was evidently something that was captured by flash and it was moving at an incredible rate of speed. I caught two or three of those, and I also caught orbs of different colors. Most orbs are like white or pale or gray, but these I captured one or two that was just really bright green. And so, yeah, I didn't really hear anything and I didn't see anything with my eye. But just being in the underground of Edinburgh was just an absolute thrill for me.
You are one of the few people that has ever developed and taught a course on psychical science research. You did that at Appalachian State University. Tell me about that course.
Sir. Well, naturally, my field of I guess expertise or whatever would be educational leadership. But we have a program at App State, which I think is an excellent program, that they have their professors, if they want, it's strictly volunteer, that you can design a course that has all the rigor of being a course that is worthy of being taught at App State, but that you can divide it on, you design it based on something that you like. And naturally, I thought, well, I'll give that a shot. And so I wrote up a really scholarly document as to, you know, well, why should we study the paranormal? One was, well, how about people like this, like Carl Jung? You know, he studied the paranormal. William James, he studied the paranormal. And then you could keep going through this list of famous people who believed. And look, Thomas Alva Edison was actually working on a phone that would reach the dead when he died. That's something, I guess, that they try to keep quiet a little bit. But anyway, I designed the course, did the literature review on the whole thing, and explained why I thought it was necessary, because that there's a lot of kids out there now, and they go, you know, they go off on these haunted, you know, we're going to go see if we can see a ghost type of thing. And there is some things that's inherently dangerous about that. And, you know, I've been a speaker at, you know, middle schools and high schools and actually other universities to where, you know, I talked about, it's one of the things that I will talk about. But the class also has to be built into the research component. And here is where my high school teachers just come back in spades, where they just said, when I would go in, I'd say, we got to research this. That means you've got to keep records. You've got to find a way to research it. And I let them pick out their particular topic. But anyway, it's called the first year seminar, and it's worth 3 hours credit, and it would go toward the degree. So this was actually a class they were taking for their degree as a general elective. And so every time I taught it, it was filled up. People couldn't get into it. And so I just really had a good time teaching that. And, you know, it's like most of the time I talk graduate students who are working on their master's or the EDS specialist degree or their doctorate. And then coming in and teaching who were predominantly freshmen, I got a chance to teach kids who are going, what if? And then you go with the graduate students and it's more of a theme of it is. This is the way that it is. But anyway, just one quick story on that. I had a young man who was really, really very interested in the course, and he was wanting to get into remote viewing. And I thought, well, that's a great topic to study. So I approved it. And he said, you know where I'm gonna try to remote view to where my sister lives, and she's in the Coast Guard. And I'm going to try to do that. And then, you know, a couple of weeks went by, and then he came up. He stayed after class. He said, I don't know what to do. He said, I've got a letter from the Coast Guard that said I would cease and desist on studying remote viewing as far as one of their properties are concerned. And so I thought, well, number one, did his sister actually bring it up to one of her superiors? Or do they go through all the mail or whatever it was? But he went on to write about spontaneous combustion of humans. But anyway, I thought that was really, really interesting that the Coast Guard jumped in and said no, because as you know, that is something that our military industrial complex has been studying for a while, is how to remote view. And but anyway, I just found that was very amusing.
Yeah, I'm wondering if somehow their psychic spies detected that he was remotely viewing one of their locations. Maybe that's how they found
out. That's fascinating. You know, I have never thought of that. And you could absolutely be right on that. Wouldn't that be something? And that's another thing that I have. If there's complaint about studying the paranormal, it's that people, you know, organizations, institutions don't tend to share everything that they get. And it's all, you know, that it's just for me. This is going to be for me. And there's not many ways to make a living, you know, studying the paranormal. And I guess I can understand that. But I think that sometimes we are shooting the collective study of the psychical sciences by not cooperating. Like I did with those three kids back in high school, I was taught to do that. You cooperate and share. So anyway, that's actually a fascinating take on that, Richard.
So in conclusion, Alvin, after nearly a lifetime investigating and researching the paranormal, are you any closer to identifying perhaps what might be behind all this?
You know, I think what I am closer to is a peace of mind that I have, because I have verified many times over that it's real. It happens to me. But some of the other things that come into play is Diane Archangel. I don't know if you know of her or you may have actually interviewed her, but she did some work a few years ago, and she did she took Carl Jung's work in the 16 different personality types, also called Myers-Briggs. And she administered that to a very large population. And what she got back was that certain, and I won't be able to tell you which one they are, there are 16, you know, different mindsets, but that certain mindsets were more capable of seeing, hearing, or believing in the paranormal as the others. And so I've just always thought that's fascinating. So I think some of the things that I've come up with is the fact that everybody is not going to experience the paranormal. And even if they did, they're going to explain it away because it's not within their paradigm of thinking. And I can understand that. But I think, you know, just from my guess, is it's entities in a different dimension. And for just one moment or two, that they can come through and communicate with a person that's actually on the another dimension trying to reach out. To answer your question, I have to say, no, I haven't been able to prove it, what it is one way or the other, but I am really satisfied that it exists. And I've long ago quit trying to prove to the world that this exists. It's enough that I know it for myself. I will be happy to talk to anybody about it. And I try to be as helpful as I can.
Well, thank you, Dr. Prophet, and thank you for hanging out for the last hour.
It's been just a delightful experience talking with you.
Okay, my thanks to Carlos Cagina and Ryan White. Back next week with journalist David Menzies from Rebel News. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light, and what I say in a whisper, proclaim from the rooftops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Or at least up the stairs. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.